Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in the San Diego Performance Academy. 46 years ago, Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination sent shockwaves across America. Dr. King once declared, "There is nothing greater in all the world than freedom. It's worth going to jail for. It's worth losing a job for. It's worth dying for." Dr. King led the fight for enactment of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act to assure equality for all people in America. He said, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." But last year, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned a key part of that Voting Rights Act. The High Court ruled that Congress needs to update a provision that allowed the federal government to require states or cities with a history of discrimination to get permission from the federal government before making any changes to their voting laws. Just in time for Martin Luther King Day this year, a bipartisan group of senators has introduced the Voting Rights Amendment Act of 2014. Their amendment would allow the federal government to once again require preclearance of new state or local laws regarding voting in areas that have a history of discrimination, but only if that history is recent. Civil rights leader and Congressman John Lewis once said that the vote is the most powerful nonviolent tool we possess in our democracy. This week, Darren Parker, chair of the California Democratic Party's African American Caucus, said that while we honor Dr. King's legacy, it is imperative that Congress work to make the Voting Rights Act whole once more. He concluded, "We simply cannot continue marching toward the more perfect union that Dr. King fought and died for if members of our society find their right to vote so easily denied."
This is Mark Gavitt reporting live for East County Magazine and KNSJ. I am on scene at the grand opening of the new performing arts complex at Hillux Charter High School. The Hillux Highlander Bagpipers have just begun playing, signaling the beginning of the ceremony. In addition to Hillux High School board members, parents, and students who attend the school, gathered here today are board members of the Grossmont School District, the mayor of La Mesa, and supervisor Diane Jacobs. All of which are preparing to speak whilst waiting for the bagpipers to end a wonderful demonstration of their talent. The first to stand and speak is Mike Lewis, executive director of Hillux Charter High School.
Almost 20 years ago, the vision for this facility began taking shape through discussions with former principal and executive director Doug Smith, former performing arts teachers Russ Sperling, Mark Falk, and Jerry Kirk, and later by our current performing arts teachers Greg Osborne, Mitch Way, Mike Benge, John Lindhorst, Katie O'Rourke, and Paul Raines. Thanks to the voters of East County who passed Proposition U in 2008, we stand here today with that dream realized. We now see before you a first-class teaching, learning, and performing facility.
A first-class learning facility is precisely what the new complex appears to be. The facility features a dramatic two-story glass entry, a 410-seat theater, dance classroom, digital arts classroom, instrumental classroom, and much more. According to Diane Jacobs, the complex is
truly phenomenal. I've not seen anything like it, and to have this be a part of Hillux High School and a part of East County makes it very, very special.
After the speeches commenced, Julian Red Falls, reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, ventured around the facility and found a student who, much like everyone else, expressed excitement for the new complex.
So I'm here with some students that are part of the performing arts program at Hillux High School. I'm wondering how they're feeling about the new building.
We love it because our last dance room was really old and like the panels on the ceiling were falling off and there was like holes. Like when it rained, we would have to set out big trash cans. Yeah, and everybody else used the dance room, like the wrestling team is in there to use it, so it smelled really bad. So now we have like just a room that's all for ourselves, and it's really nice, and it has nice mirrors and a nice sound system and like dressing rooms for us. It's really nice.
Julian Red Falls also happened to bump into Raquel Vasquez, councilwoman for Lemon Grove. Here's what she had to say.
This facility is awesome. Let me tell you, you know, there's learning and then there's art. And when you put it all together, it makes a well-rounded individual.
La Mesa Police Chief Ed Aceves believes that not only will the new complex help the students, but the community at large.
This is a great opportunity to provide some state-of-the-art facilities for young kids that are very talented, that, you know, in the past maybe not had the best facilities, but now they do. And it's very exciting, not only for the school, but for the community, because I'm sure there's other entities in the community that will also be using this facility. I think it's great.
Overall, the new complex has already shown to be an awesome addition to Hilux High School. Based on hopes and predictions, the new performing arts complex will certainly benefit the entire community at large.
Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery with an important health alert from the County of San Diego. 6 more influenza-related deaths were reported in the San Diego area last week, according to the County Health and Human Services Agency. That brings the total to 7 flu-related deaths so far this season, and all of them tested positive for the pandemic H1N1 flu. The people who died ranged in age from 35 to 80 years old, and they all had underlying medical conditions. But only one of them is known to have received the flu shot. Last season, 65 flu-related deaths were reported countywide. Now, compared to last season, a significantly higher proportion of young and middle-aged adults are being reported with this flu. County health officials are encouraging everybody to get immunized to help protect yourself and your loved ones against this flu, especially now that the flu activity is widespread across the region and the state. Now, the current flu vaccine does offer protection against pandemic H1N1, influenza A, H3N2, and the influenza B strains. But it takes about 2 weeks for immunity to develop after getting vaccinated, so it's important not to delay getting the vaccine. And I will say that I have had this bad flu this season, and trust me, folks, you don't want to get it. Get that vaccine. County Health Official Wilma Wooten says that although the influenza activity in San Diego has increased greatly over the last month, it is not too late to get immunized. Influenza can be a serious and even deadly disease, especially for the elderly and young infants, as well as people with chronic conditions such as heart disease or diabetes. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, recommends that everyone 6 months and older get a flu vaccine each year. The vaccine is especially important for people who are at higher risk of serious complications from the flu, such as those with underlying medical conditions, pregnant women, and those 65 or older. To avoid catching or spreading the flu, the county health officials also recommend that you wash your hands thoroughly and often, use hand sanitizers, clean surfaces that are commonly touched in your home and office, and if you're sick, please stay home and avoid contact with others. The vaccine is available throughout San Diego County at doctor's offices and retail pharmacies. County public health centers also have flu vaccine available for children and adults who don't have medical insurance. For a list of locations, you can visit www.sdiz.org or you can call 211.
This is Ed Barena reporting for KNSJ. Governor Jerry Brown has issued an emergency declaration due to the third straight year of drought. We're facing perhaps the worst drought that California has ever seen since records began being kept about 100 years ago, Governor Brown announced. He asked all Californians to cut water use by 20%. Water conservation is voluntary for now, but could become mandatory if conditions worsen. The governor also directed state agencies to hire more seasonal firefighters. Agriculture is also being hard hit by the drought, and conditions are expected to worsen over the next few weeks with no rain forecast. Up to 200,000 acres of farmland could be fallowed. Governor Brown said he hopes to receive some help from the federal government after issuing the emergency drought declaration. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has designated parts of 11 states as natural disaster areas due to the drought, including portions of California, making farmers eligible for low-interest emergency loans to cover their losses. However, San Diego is not on the list of areas eligible for such help. Despite the governor's emergency declaration, the San Diego County Water Authority says it has adequate supplies for 2014 because of local investments in diverse and reliable water supplies and a decline in demand for water in our region. The San Diego region imports about 85% of its water supplies, and this year's imports are expected to be very low. But fortunately, the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, the largest provider of water to our region, says it has adequate stored water reserves for this year. The San Diego region's water users have made great strides in water use efficiency. Water use per person has decreased about 27% since 2007. In addition, the Water Authority and its member agencies have made significant investments to diversify San Diego County's water supply sources. Those include the Carlsbad Desalination Project, which is under construction and is expected to start commercial production in early 2016. It will produce enough locally controlled, drought-proof water to serve about 112,000 homes in our region. The State Water Agency offers these tips to reduce your water usage. Replace old toilets and clothes washers with new models if possible. Find or repair leaks. Take shorter showers or switch to a low-flow showerhead. Turn off faucets when not in use. Cut lawn watering to the minimum and fix broken irrigation systems, since residential irrigation accounts for a third of all urban water use. The County Water Authority and its 24 member agencies offer rebates, tools, and educational programs to improve water use efficiency at homes, businesses, and institutions. For more information, go to the WaterSmart link at www.sdcwa.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
California Public Utilities Commissioner Mark Farron has resigned due to his battle with cancer. In his final report to the PUC, Commissioner Farron voiced concerns over utility companies' efforts to kill rooftop solar and warned of pressures placed on commissioners from the utility industry. Commissioner Farron played a key role in major PUC decisions that impact San Diego County. He recommended denial of the Quail Brush Power Plant application near Mission Trails, finding no need for the facility at that time, though the PUC, which adopted his position, left the door open for the applicant to resubmit that proposal this year. Commissioner Farron also authored a PUC decision that denied San Diego Gas and Electric Company's request to charge ratepayers for liability costs of wildfires caused by SDG&E lines and equipment. In his final report to the PUC, Farron also had this to say: "We are fortunate to have utilities in California that are orders of magnitude more enlightened than their brethren in the coal-loving states, although I suspect that they would still dearly like to strangle rooftop solar if they could." He said commissioners need to watch our utilities management and their legal and compliance advisors very, very carefully. Farron said of the regulator's role, "This is cat and mouse, not partnership, so we have to be one smart and aggressive cat." He also spoke out about net metering, noting that the thorny issue of net energy metering and rate design has been given to the PUC by the legislature recently. But, he warned, recognize that this is a poisoned chalice. The commission will come under intense pressure to use this authority to protect the interest of the utilities over those of consumers and potential self-generators, all in the name of addressing exaggerated concerns about grid stability, cost, and fairness. He urged his fellow commissioners to be bold and forthright in defending and strengthening our state's commitment to clean and distributed energy. Commissioner Farron was appointed by Governor Jerry Brown to the PUC in March of 2011. In response to Commissioner Farron's resignation, PUC President Michael Peavy praised Farron as a man with tremendous inner strength, adding, "We wish him the best and look forward to the day when we can raise our glasses in a toast to his recovery." Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Ed Barreno with KNSJ, the Health Report. Are babies and children at risk of suppressed immune systems from wildfire smoke? A new study at the University of California, Davis, suggests this could be the case. The study was conducted by the university and by the California Air Resources Board. It looked at 25 young rhesus monkeys born at the university's Primate Research Center during the summer of 2008, when smoke from over 2,000 fires that burned over a million acres drifted into the area. The monkeys born during the wildfires, and who were living outdoors, were found to have suppressed immune systems. Their blood samples were placed in tissue culture dishes, then exposed to disease pathogens. When compared to 25 other monkeys born a year later, they showed a reduced ability to generate immune responses to diseases. Lisa Miller, professor of veterinary medicine at UC Davis, called the findings surprising and somewhat disturbing. Before, conventional wisdom in medicine had assumed that smoke or other irritants would cause the immune system to ramp up, but instead this study found just the opposite. Researchers also measured the effects of fine particulate matter lodged deep in the lungs and found very high levels. Wildfire smoke also causes high ozone levels, which is linked to asthma, lower birth weights, and heart problems. Development of children's lungs, which take 18 years to fully mature, is also a key concern. another study is planned at the University of California, this time on the impacts of wildfire smoke on people living there. The findings are particularly troubling here in wildfire-prone San Diego's East County, which in 2003 and 2007 had the two worst firestorms in California history. With climate change bringing hotter, drier weather, more severe fires are predicted. If smoke from fires can harm the lungs and immune systems of children, that could have implications for CAL FIRE and the Forest Service, which have increased controlled burns as a means of preventing out-of-control wildfires. We don't know yet if that would prevent us from using prescribed fires as a tool, Forest Service ecologist Andrzej Bitnarowicz said, the Sacramento Bee reports. Meanwhile, it's best to err on the side of caution when the next wildfire strikes. Keep children indoors if possible until the smoke clears.
How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they leave
Harry? This is Miriam Raftery with this week's agricultural report. The county is considering changes to its zoning ordinance for boutique and small wineries, but local vintners say the added regulation could crush our region's growing winemaking industry. On Friday morning, a meeting with county planners was held in the County Operations Center where winery owners voiced their strong objections. Terry Kearns is president of the Ramona Ranch Winery and the editor of the Ramona Valley Wine Region magazine. In a letter to the County Planning and Development Services, she wrote that the proposed changes would, quote, destroy our new industry if a adopted and would be the most restrictive grape-growing, farming, and winemaking ordinance in California. Supervisor Diane Jacob sent a message to constituents who voiced concerns. She said, while we've had great success since the adoption of our tiered winery ordinance, county staff is exploring potential changes to the ordinance that would provide greater clarification on a number of issues such as special events. She added that any proposed changes would have to come before the supervisors and that she will give careful consideration to all information before reaching a decision. Terry Kearns raised concerns on several points. The proposed changes would restrict sales of wine produced off-site. So that would impact, for example, a winery that wants to offer a Chardonnay for tasting but can't grow Chardonnay grapes locally. In addition, the county proposes imposing new restrictions on events at local wineries. The changes would also require that a winery have a permit and be bonded before producing any wine and would eliminate the by-right zoning allowances. A winery would have to have a commercial building, not use an existing agricultural structure such as a barn. Terry Kern said that would wipe out up to 98% of wineries currently in operation. She added, these requirements would make it costly and prohibitive for most small vintners to open a winery. Every area of the ordinance, they're basically shredding. And that's ironic because the county recently fought all the way to the California Supreme Court to protect its new boutique winery ordinance, and the high court upheld it. The proposal is opposed by the San Diego County Vintners Association and by the Ramona Valley Vintners Association here in East County.
This is Ed Barena reporting for KNSJ and East County Magazine. The Education Trust has named San Diego State University as a model for improving graduation rates, especially among low-income students and students of color. Over a decade, from 2002 to 2011, graduation rates among Latino students nearly doubled, from 31.4% to 58.8%. Latino students are now a quarter of all graduates at SDSU. SDSU was one of eight universities recognized by the Education Trust for its success in improving graduation rates. SDSU President Elliot Hirschman said, "This recognition is a tribute to the creativity, dedication, and perseverance of our faculty, staff, students, and administrators." Katie Haycock, president of the Education Trust, says growth in economic inequality in recent decades shows that simply letting more disadvantaged students in isn't enough. Haycock said colleges need to assume their share of responsibility for making sure students have the supports they need to complete. SDSU has committed to closing the achievement gap through a variety of programs aimed at fostering student success and creating culture for students starting as early as elementary school to encourage them to get a college education. For instance, the Educational Opportunity Program provides help to over 1,500 low-income first-generation college students. Another program, Compact for Success, aims at creating a college-going culture in underserved middle and high schools in our region. Other programs help new freshmen avoid falling behind and help commuting students find access to study space and services that previously were available only to students who lived on campus.
Now we have an announcement for Lakeside residents. The Lakeside Community Planning Group has announced a vacancy due to the resignation of Chad Ennis. Applications are now being accepted to fill the seat short-term since the term of office expires January 1, 2015. The Board of Supervisors will appoint a qualified candidate. The Lakeside Community Planning Group will recommend a candidate to the supervisors. Applicants must reside in the Lakeside planning area to be eligible for appointment. Candidates must be at least 18 years old, be registered to vote in the area they wish to represent, and disclose any financial interests in real estate or business in the jurisdiction. Membership qualifications and an application form can be accessed at the County Clerk's website or by calling the County Clerk's office at 619-531-5600. The deadline to apply is March 5th at 6:30 p.m. An application must contain contact information and a statement of eligibility, a resume, and a statement as to why you want to serve. Applications can be delivered by mail or in person to the chair or co-chair of the Lakeside Community Planning Group. Candidates can apply directly to the supervisors, but be aware that if you don't submit your application to the planning group, you will not be considered for the group's recommendation. Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Governor Jerry Brown's budget proposal is getting high marks from those who want to see proceeds from cap-and-trade auctions go toward cleaning up pollution in low-income communities. The state borrowed against the carbon pollution funds last year, but this time the governor wants to spend $600 million on sustainable communities and clean transportation. Vian Trung with the Green Lighting Institute says this will help communities near oil refineries and chemical plants that have been hit hardest by pollution and climate change.
We have low-income communities and communities of color that really need to benefit from these revenues. Those are the folks that we are most concerned about. We want to make sure they're receiving the funds immediately.
Mary Rose Turek with the Asian Pacific Environmental Network says the time to invest these revenues is now. She says Brown's budget proposal includes funding for many shovel-ready projects that can help reduce emissions, create jobs, and improve air quality statewide.
Those would go towards helping low-income communities save money on energy bills and generate green jobs. There's also $100 million for sustainable communities, as well as millions of dollars for urban forestry programs.
California law requires proceeds from cap-and-trade auctions be used for projects that further the goals of the state's landmark clean energy law, AB 32. For Public News Service, I'm Laurie Abbott.
This is Miriam Raftery with this week's local government. Lemon Grove City Council meets on Tuesday, January 22nd. Council members will consider a moratorium prohibiting new smoke shops. Council will also hold a hearing on vending machines and kiosks and discuss whether to form a working group on the extension of Lemon Grove's Main Street promenade. Santee holds its city council meeting on Wednesday, January 22nd. The council will consider a resolution to enter into a professional services agreement to develop a sustainable Santee action plan. In La Mesa, the Community Services Commission will hold a public hearing on January 29th at 6 o'clock at the La Mesa Community Center to consider a request to permanently remove the tennis court at Collier Park and install four dedicated pickleball courts with nets. A community meeting is set for February 5th at the Hamul School for residents concerned about a casino planned at the Hamul Indian Village. The County of San Diego has filed a lawsuit against Caltrans over the agency's approval of the project's traffic plan, which the county contends is inadequate on accident-prone Highway 94. In addition, a citizens group called Hamulians Against Casinos has filed suits against the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the National Indian Gaming Commission challenging the tribe's right to have gambling on its property. The tribe has made many changes to its original plans in an effort to accommodate community concerns, and tribal leadership contends that the project is needed to provide jobs and help lift tribal members out of poverty. You can find more details on these projects, including links to full agendas for local boards and councils, at our website, www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This is Mark Gavitt reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ. County supervisors unanimously approved new sign rules Wednesday. People living in or visiting San Diego County's unincorporated communities may soon start seeing a lot more signs, welcoming them to town, telling them about special events, or directing them to local attractions. Because the rule changes will create a new county ordinance, the action must be approved by the board again when they meet January 29th and would take effect 30 days after that. The staff report that was presented to the board Wednesday said that allowing signs to be put up on county roads could establish a greater sense of place and community character, without sacrificing road safety.
The new rules would allow six types of community signs and banners to be put up in the public right-of-way in unincorporated communities. Supervisor Bill Horn says, "Signs bring new visitors and visitors bring money, and that's pretty simple."
Against a backdrop of a church choir wearing Chargers blue and gold last Sunday, January 6th, Elizabeth Maldonado Robinson and Sister Justine Church with the Interfaith Committee for Worker Justice spoke about worker inequality to the congregation at United Church of Christ in La Mesa. The oppression of workers' rights is occurring locally, they said. Maldonado Robinson spoke about the plight of hotel workers at the elegant Hyatt Hotel in La Jolla, for example. Management received many sanctions for violating labor rules, including refusing to allow workers to take breaks and refusing to meet collectively with employees. One worker who met individually with her manager was told that if she wanted a break, she would have to take it in a closet full of toxic cleaning supplies. Finally, the manager agreed to let the hotel workers organize, due to protests organized by the Interfaith Committee for Worker Justice of San Diego County. These are the kinds of struggles that the committee is working to transform. The Interfaith Committee for Worker Justice was started by Rabbi Laura Kosky in 1998. Her activities have included working to abolish labor trafficking, being a witness to workers' stories of abuse, and seeking to gently persuade management to improve conditions for workers. Many of the workers who are abused are undocumented immigrants who feel they have little or no power to oppose harsh management practices. The Interfaith Committee for Worker Justice in San Diego strives to help both legal and undocumented immigrants, believing that all people are equal in the eyes of God. The committee is a multi-faith coalition with interfaith workers and members including Catholics and other Christians, Jews, Muslims, and people of all faiths. The committee advocates for living wages, safe working conditions, a voice on the job, access to quality health care, and ending slave-like labor conditions. Its members have conducted solidarity campaigns at such well-known businesses as the La Jolla Marriott, Humphrey's Half Moon Inn, Walmart, fast food restaurants, security companies, taxi companies, and other local locations. The organization strives to have religious and business leaders work together toward the goal of all low-wage workers, including employees and independent contractors, being paid a living wage that meets the basic needs of their families and receive full health care benefits. They also seek to have all companies follow applicable laws, including the rights to organize. Recent efforts include seeking higher wages for fast food workers and striving to help security guards receive proper training, fair wages, and benefits. Worker inequality is becoming a major issue in politics today. Last week was the 50th anniversary of the war on poverty, yet the gap between rich and poor has widened, and many more Americans are falling into poverty in recent years. President Obama addressed the issue by speaking about reinstating federal unemployment extension benefits and raising the minimum wage. Some may consider the issues of a fair wage, fair working conditions, and affordable health care as creeping socialism or tax-and-spend liberalism, but others just see it as common sense. To learn more about the Interfaith Committee for Worker Justice, you can visit the organization's website at www.icwj.org. Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians. The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Wes Albers, author of the novel Black and White, published by Zova Press, and a police sergeant with more than 20 years in law enforcement. My guest is also the director of the Southern California Writers Conference, an organization that helps writers develop their craft. He's worked extensively with editors, best-selling novelists, and other industry professionals. Welcome, Wes. It's a pleasure to see you and have you here in the studio.
It's good to be here.
Let's begin with Black and White, which is a police crime novel, and it's the first of a series. I know that New York Times bestselling author T. Jefferson calls it a book with guts and heart and humor, a serious consideration of both the light and dark sides of our nature. Tell me a little bit about your motivation to write the book and to star your protagonist, who a street cop named John Hatch. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, originally I'd really rather write sci-fi or fantasy. So
really?
I didn't set out to write a police procedural. And then I really got hounded during one of the conferences by an agent and an editor who were really kind of tag teaming me. Mm-hmm. And so I agreed to sit down and write a chapter and see what I thought. And so when I sat down, I probably wrote what is now the prologue in the first chapter in about 40 minutes. And what I found out of that was a character that I could relate to, that I thought spoke with an authenticity of a street cop. Mm-hmm. And by and large, that's my experience, my background professionally. And so suddenly it became about telling the story of a street cop. Everybody likes to write about detectives.
Right.
And, you know, you've always got some rogue detective captain or lieutenant running around solving the world's crimes.
Right.
But few people write about the street cop. And realistically, they're where the rubber meets the road. They're where it all happens. And so I wanted to tell that story.
So what do you have in common with the street cop?
Well, as my background, I spent bulk of my career, certainly all my formative time, working on the streets. I could go back to work in the streets this afternoon and be plenty happy out there. But that's really where it's where life happens. It's, you know, you're there for some of the best and worst moments in people's lives. So when you want to talk about drama and mm-hmm. and life and what happens and what moves us, what changes us, mm-hmm. That's where you really see it firsthand.
Can you give us an example of some of the things in life that your character runs into? Give us a teaser.
Well, you know, it's Black and White's really more about the day-to-day challenges of trying to balance having a personal life with a professional life and mm-hmm. and dealing with the administrative hassles and some of the issues. So, but it's also about dealing with the challenges of the streets. And, you know, when I thought about the book, it's how does a good person stay good when they're dealing with daily with the dark realities often of
right.
humanity. And so it's really about the challenges to remain human or humane in an inhuman world sometimes.
Right, to avoid the burnout.
Yeah, yeah. And that's really what kind of the story is, really more of a character-based exploration of law enforcement. It's first person. Mm-hmm. And part of that is that, you know, I wanted people to go along for the ride and know.
Right.
Know what it's like from an officer's perspective, not from this hindsight perspective or third person where you have this omniscient view of everything that's going on. When you make a decision, certainly in this book, while you're with the character, you're making that decision on only what information they have.
Right.
And even though a decision may later look unreasonable, mm-hmm. it may very well look reasonable at the time it's getting made.
So it's not a Hollywood view, sort of. It's more realistic.
Absolutely, and I think that's the big draw. Mm-hmm. Cops across this country have commented on making a connection with these characters. Cal State San Marcos sought it out and used it as a textbook because of the authenticity of the voice and the experiences.
Wonderful. So, well, I know that you've also served as detective sergeant in charge of border investigations, mm-hmm. and supervising emergency negotiation teams. Have any of those aspects of law enforcement influenced your writing or your career choices?
It all does. You know, like I said, right now I'm really kind of writing from the street cop perspective, but I think some of that more the broader experience, the investigative experience, the negotiations and dealing with crisis, all of that kind of weaves back into to experiences and insight that lets me kind of speak to a mm-hmm. to a broader nature of life and exposure to mm-hmm. life.
And let me ask you this. Writing is mostly a solitary, quiet activity.
Absolutely.
Is that something that is very enjoyable after the edginess of being out there and dealing with crime? Is that something you savor, or is it difficult?
No, it's absolutely. I mean, writing is something I've done long before I was in law enforcement. So you want to look at a career, writing's really the longer career for me. But it's something separate from, and I like the release. I like the thought of going out and imagining, and that's probably where I'm drawn to sci-fi and fantasy, is that that's really speculative fiction, and and you can go on out and push boundaries and explore and imagine and dream, and so all of that wrapped into the creative process and trying to put something together to tell something compelling.
Right.
Absolutely, it's a release.
And I ask this to almost all the authors I interview, but when do you find time to write? What is your routine? What works for you with such a busy day job?
I have no routine.
Okay.
That's my biggest challenge. Mm-hmm. I know that Zova Books would love the second book out yesterday, if I could do it, and probably the third book out tomorrow. And they've been very supportive, very good to work with. But the challenge and the reality is mine can sometimes be a 7/24 job.
Right.
And so I write when I can. And I try to build in a rhythm and a routine, but I guarantee it lasts maybe a week or two. And then something throws hand grenades.
And does that cause continuity problems in the writing process itself?
Yes and no. You know, I try to explain it when I talk to people. It's not like you can just sit down and write a chapter. Mm-hmm. You've got to download the book into your brain. And you really got to, have kind of the full picture context before you sit and write. Because everything you put in there has to have relevance to all that has happened and all that's going to happen.
Right.
And then there's little subtle little plot devices and things like that that have to hit timing benchmarks in order to make this workable. So yeah, it can have an issue, but usually what happens is that it just, when I start getting back into it after a delay, it's lag time until I write more.
Right. So you just have to get back into the flow.
You just have to.
Let's talk a little bit about another hat that you wear, your position as director of the Southern California Writers Conference, which I understand is in its 28th year. And it takes place every year during President's Day weekend in San Diego. I know that conference is by and for writers. What can you tell us about your work at the conference and the really important lessons that you've picked up for those new and experienced writers out there?
First and foremost, you know, publishing's not an event. It's a process. It's a journey.
I like that.
And by and large, and you mentioned it earlier, we write in isolation, but we publish in community.
Absolutely.
And certainly we prosper in community.
Mm-hmm.
You can have the best book in the world, but unless somebody carries that forward, oftentimes unless many people carry that forward, unless they carry your banner and push for you and give you exposure to other people, the best book in the world can languish and die, even on the front shelf of Barnes and Noble, you know? And so one of the things the conference gives me, I think the biggest thing, is that opportunity to really participate and kind of drive that sense of community, to create an environment where there's certainly an aspect that's about, I love when an author gets published.
Mm-hmm.
I love when their dreams are realized.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the event. What I love more is when we can participate in that journey and people are collaborative and they have that sense of community and that interaction. And certainly, you know, you develop long-lasting friendships and relationships out of this environment. That, to me, is kind of the coolest thing.
After so many years of participating in the conference, do you still learn something?
Oh, every time. And I think realistically, more so today than before, publishing, the industry of publishing has changed so much.
Right.
Just in the last 5-6 years,
mm-hmm.
To where I think a writer really has more opportunity for voice than at any time in the history of our planet.
More choices, right?
More choices,
mm-hmm.
but also more hazards and more challenges. And so one of the things that's always kind of a major topic of discussion for Michael and I when we're planning this our conference is, how do we stay relevant? How do we stay ahead of this curve? How do we provide resources for some of these other avenues that didn't exist 2 or 3 years ago?
Right.
But then also, how do we provide that in a context that people can make informed, responsible choices, and that they understand that if you're going to if you're going to go on a traditional path, these are things you still need to do. If you're going to deviate from that path, these are things you need to understand, and these are dangers and pitfalls, and these can be potential this could be a potential ramification. If you don't do this, that could do that, but yet, you know, this could be all of a sudden the biggest thing that's ever happened to you. It's an informed decision is really what it's mm-hmm. about. And so this gives us an opportunity to have some of those discussions and help people navigate. Certainly, you know, my experience has been there's a lot of people out there professing to be experts, but then there's also a lot of sharks
yes.
out there. And you need to have a foundation to be able to make informed decisions and be your own advocate.
So in a way, the conference is watching the writer's back, in a sense, helping them guide them through and making the decisions.
Absolutely. We do our very best on that.
It sounds great. Your website states that you've helped facilitate $4 million worth of first-time book and movie deals for authors through the conference and through your contacts. In your opinion, is the traditional route still the best route? Or, I mean, how much of it is contacts and hard work versus luck and timing? Or does it completely depend on the individual case?
Yeah, it's a case by case.
Okay.
And you know, to be fair, that's certainly not $4 million that I've done. That's the conference. And that's a lot of people.
Right.
And a lot of people who really care, who are working together, kind of interconnected, mentoring, leading, carrying people through, helping them refine their stuff, reaching out to contacts. You know, I can't say, I'll put it this way. If you're looking to get published, I don't know anybody that if a major publishing house came along and says, we want to publish your book and we're going to pay you well to do it, I don't know anybody that's going to say, well, you know, I'd really rather not. No, that's not true. I know a couple people. But those are people that are so dialed in marketing and their own community and outreach that they can successfully navigate, say, independent publishing or self-publishing and do better in their mind or at least have more control over where stuff goes than if they went a traditional route. But by and large, traditional publishing is decades and decades of history that has built-in channels that certainly a lot of people will never build anything close to that on their own. So I don't know that one's better than the other. I know this, that no matter what path you go, you really have to be the very best at what you're doing there. There is no, sometimes you'll see these people that see and they come out of the blue and it's like, oh, look, this person all of a sudden made millions of dollars off this book. They're a first timer. It's an out of the blue. It's a, oh, look, it's a dream success story. For those that do happen, they're at such an astronomical minority. But the reality is there's a machine behind that success. It's not just a random, I've uploaded my book onto onto Amazon and all of a sudden it's the bestseller. There are a lot of other elements that go into that. And for people that want to be in this business, it's knowing how to navigate, knowing where you fit. I tell people all the time, if you think you have a book, if you're good enough and you've got enough background in this business that you really think this is a industry kind of traditional publishing style book, you need to exhaust all those angles before you start self-publishing it or going down through some other route. Because once you do that, you might very well close your door to the original route. And so it's understanding some of those things.
Okay. Well, some information for people out there to chew on. One last question for you. What book are you writing on now, and when can we expect to see it?
Right now I'm working on the second for Black and White, follow-up to that. I had hoped Christmas time this year. Christmas time last year, Black and White did tremendously well on iTunes and has stayed pretty visible there as a police procedural. But again, that kind of goes back to some of the writing versus life. And with luck, I will have it out for a summer read. That's really for a summer read.
Okay.
And that'll be my plan if I get it out.
So we'll hope for that deadline.
That's really the plan. I've kind of retooled some scheduling stuff to make that happen a little more.
And is there a title?
Not yet.
Not yet.
I've got a couple that I'm bouncing around.
Well, we'll look out for it. Wes, our time is up, but thank you again for joining us.
Oh, not a problem. I appreciate being here. Thank you for, you know, doing this on behalf of writers.
Oh, I enjoy it too. For more information on Wes Albers, his work, and his blog, please visit his website at www.authorwesalbers.com. And for more information on the Southern California Writers Conference, please visit www.writersconference.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun.
I love mulch. Mulch is one of my favorite words because of what it does for us. Here in Southern California, we desperately need mulch. If you've traveled abroad, you've gone to France, you've gone to England, and you've seen that back there, they use something called dust mulch. This is where they go in with a little cultivator and they rake up a little pile of loose soil on the soil surface, and they view that as mulching. And it works for them because it rains about every 30 minutes over there. But we're in Southern California, and our sun is hot, and it blazes down. First, the definition of mulch is, it's anything that you use as a barrier between the sun and the soil. And that's probably the number one wonderful aspect of mulch. It will make your plants much happier. They will grow better because they won't be going through a constant cycle of I'm wet, Now I'm hot. Now I'm dry. Now I'm wet. So the mulch is the blanket that provides a much more serene landscape for your plants. They will be much happier without going through the constant wet, dry, wet, dry, wet, dry cycle. You will also find that it will help your water bill because the mulch will help you stretch out between waterings. When you change and start using 3 inches of mulch, yes, 3 inches of mulch on your plants, you will find that you don't need to water nearly so often. Plants that you had to water every third or fourth day may go a week very easily between waterings. That's certainly going to be helpful. But there are other things that mulch does too. I've seen those gardens in France and England because I love to travel. But when I come home, I have no interest in spending another month weeding. That's not my idea of fun at all. The mulch makes it so that I don't need to weed all the time. 3 inches of mulch means that very few weeds are going to come up. You can pull the ones that do come up very easily because they're wimpy and they have weak stems. You can do it just by bending over and jerking them out of the ground. Now, this does take a little work up front. If you have a half an acre of weeds right now, you have to get down to bare ground before you put the mulch on them. So you will need a hula hoe, and hopefully you can then rake up the stuff and make it go away because it's going to be old dry weeds full of weed seeds. If you're doing this in the early part of the year when those weeds are still green, those make great compost additions for your compost barrel. Now, once you've got the bare ground, either around your existing garden or starting from scratch, put down 3 inches of mulch. The mulch can be either organic or inorganic. I personally do not care much for putting down weed barrier underneath things. When I put down mulch, I put it on the bare ground. People who are insecure about that could put down 4 to 6 layers of newspaper, and that would be good. Whatever you do, don't put down black plastic. Don't let anybody talk you into putting plastic underneath your mulch, because the black plastic is going to tear and the edges are going to come up. Soon, within 2 or 3 years, you will have these lovely pieces of black plastic floating around your landscape. This is not something that most of us want to see. What is the mulch? You can get leftover tree prunings. You can get leaves that you've run through a shredder. You can go buy wonderful mulch at either the Sycamore or the Miramar landfill. You can use whatever you have for mulch. You can also do inorganic mulches. You can put down half-inch gravel. You can put down pea gravel. You can buy bark. There are so many choices that you can use. My favorite mulch of all time is called Gorilla Hair. Gorilla hair is redwood it's the leftovers from when they mill the redwood. And so it binds together beautifully. It's kind of a rusty color, which is why it has the name gorilla hair. And it lasts a long time. It's great for use on slopes. Try it. You'll like it.
How prepared are you for an emergency? Of course, emergencies such as an earthquake or a blackout can happen at any time with no advance warning. For households with children, elderly people, or those with limited mobility, being ready to take action is especially important. Updating your emergency list should start with a checklist. Be sure to have enough supplies for everyone, including people and pets. Check the dates on canned goods and other perishables, and be sure that stored drinking water is still good. Create an emergency plan for your family. Identify 2 places for the family to meet. One should be somewhere outside your home, but close by, perhaps a neighbor's or a street corner. The other should be a spot away from your neighborhood, just in case the entire area is evacuated and you can't return. Using information from SDG&E and supplementing it with some additional tips, we've come up with the following helpful suggestions to be prepared. Practice an evacuation plan with your family, including children. If they get used to doing something when there is no panic, they will be much less frantic should a real disaster strike. Review emergency plans at your workplace, your child's school or daycare center, friends' homes, and other places where members of your family regularly spend time. Plan safe routes away from your home and business to high, safe ground, and be sure all family members know the routes. Have alternative routes in mind if the first option is blocked. Develop a plan for family pets and livestock, and have a backup plan because some evacuation shelters may not allow animals. Designate a friend or family member outside the area who all family members can call if you become separated. Have family members memorize that phone number in case cell phones die and you can't access the phone directory. Keep current important documents in a safe deposit box or send copies outside the area to be kept by a trusted relative or friend. Be sure that you can access your insurance policy and have a copy of your deed, for example. Have a set place for your emergency supplies. Your emergency kit should include, at minimum, a 3-day supply of bottled water, 1 gallon per person per day, plus extra for pets or anyone with special needs, a 3-day supply of packaged, dried, and canned food that can be prepared without cooking, a first aid kit, and essential medicines for all family members, a pet carrier for each pet and pet food, a manual can opener, a portable radio, plenty of batteries, and flashlights kept in waterproof bags, an extra set of car keys, credit cards, and always plenty of cash in case the power is out when ATM machines and credit card machines are not working. Special items for infants, elderly, or disabled family members. It's also important to make sure that you always keep plenty of gas in your car since pumps won't work when the power goes out. Also be sure you have a car charger for your cell phones since during a power outage you don't want your cell phone to go dead. Car chargers are cheap, often less than $10, but can be crucial in an emergency. Know how to operate everything if the electricity is off, the keyless entry to your home, and an electric garage door and gates, for instance. Be sure you know how to open them manually. If you have a gas main, know how to shut it off in case of a leak or a disaster. Include instructions on how to shut off anything that's complicated in your family emergency kit. It's better to have supplies ready and never need them than to need them and not have them. SDG&E has also prepared some videos on fire season planning and general emergency preparedness that can be accessed in the Wildfire and Emergency section of our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.